Good morning. It's Wednesday, April 10th. The war in the Middle East is now 187 days old. I'm Jonathan Shanzer, Senior Vice President for Research at Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Welcome back to the FDD Morning Brief. Well, the mixed messages continue. Prime Minister Netanyahu says he has a date to enter the last bastion of Hamas control in the Gaza town of Rafah. Defense Minister Gallant, however, says that they don't have a date. The U.S. State Department spokesman says that Israel cannot conduct maneuvers in Rafah, but sources at the White House are less unequivocal. Clear as mud? You bet. Par for the course? Yes, indeed. I dare say it's a balagan. And as always, we try to make sense of it here on this program every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. That, in essence, is the FDD Morning Brief. Our guest this morning is Rebecca Heinrichs. She's a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. She's an adjunct professor at the Institute for World Politics. She sits on the Strategic Posture Commission, the U.S. Strategic Command Advisory Group, and the National Independent Panel on Military Readiness. I don't know if we'll have enough time to unpack what all of that means, but we will speak with Rebecca in just a few minutes about Israeli missile defense and other relevant matters live right here on the FDD Morning Brief. I have a question. And I think I know the answer. Has there ever been a foreign war fought by a foreign power more heavily influenced by U.S. politics? I struggle to identify one in recent history or even since the founding of the Republic. I get it. The U.S. provides $3.8 billion a year in military assistance to Israel, and to some extent, Israeli warfighting reflects on us. But we know that the crazy woke talk of genocide is simply false. We also know the IDF has had a remarkably low ratio of civilian to terrorist casualties, even more remarkable given the challenging conditions that they face. Biden is avoiding confrontation with Iran and its proxies, and he's slamming Israel for fighting Hamas because his advisors think it will help him in November. I'm old enough to remember when wartime presidents commanded respect and popularity. Whatever happened to that? But this isn't even Biden's war. Our bizarre politics are now blocking a just war waged by a longtime ally against a designated terrorist group, Hamas, that is a proxy for a designated state sponsor of terrorism, Iran. Israel's moves are limited now, other than to clear the internally displaced out of Rafah and to make one last push for a hostage deal. After that, I suspect they will advance. And I won't blame them, but it could come at as a cost. But what really bothers me, the actors who launched this war, Iran, Hamas, and Hezbollah, don't seem to be under any significant pressure from the White House. Why is only Israel getting squeezed? I'm asking for a friend. Now for your headlines. Headline one, CENTCOM, also known as U.S. Central Command, is taking large amounts of weapons captured en route from Iran to the Houthis and sending them on to Ukraine. The amount of weaponry is staggering. 5,000 AK-47s, sniper rifles, RPGs, machine guns, and 500,000 rounds of ammo. It was a nice haul. And this is what smart policy looks like. We stick it to the Houthis, which means we're sticking it to Iran. And we also get to stick it to Putin. That's a lot of sticking it to other people that deserve to get it, which is what we should be doing all the time, not giving our adversaries a free pass. More like this, please. And thank you, CENTCOM. Headline two, Germany is taking heat for some of its pro-Israel positions. This is random. The country of Paraguay has filed a charge against the government in Berlin for supporting what they call Israeli genocide. Germany has fired back and unapologetically stated that Israel's security is at the core of the country's foreign policy. Such principled positions are rare these days, to put it mildly. I've got a new piece on this at Commentary Magazine, so if you haven't had enough of me already, I suggest you check it out. But I'll cede here that Germany's policy is informed by its terrible past. Supporting Israel doesn't mean that Germany agrees with everything that the Israelis do. They simply don't make a point of hammering Israel publicly. When they disagree quietly. Paging President Biden. Maybe take a page out of that German handbook. Just a suggestion. And headline three. The Deputy Secretary of the U.S. Treasury, Wally Adeyemo, admitted that for Iran, quote, any dollar that they have will go towards their violent activity before they deal with their people, end quote. He said this at a Senate banking hearing, and it's important because Adeyemo is the number two at Treasury, and he seems to acknowledge that sanctions relief to Iran will only increase the regime's ability to fund its violent proxies. This would be an acknowledgement that the current policy of relaxed sanctions and waivers is taking us down the wrong path. That obviously raises an important question. Will the Biden administration start turning the financial screws on the regime in Iran now that they seem to have seen the light? Existing sanctions can be more rigorously applied. And Wally, feel free to give my FDD colleagues a ring. We've got lots of potential targets here. There are plenty of new policies and even legislation that could lead to greater political and economic isolation. The door is open. All we need is for the president to walk through it. I'm now pleased to introduce Rebecca Heinrichs of the Hudson Institute. She's one of my go-tos in Washington on missile defense. In fact, I first learned to appreciate Rebecca's expertise in this space when she worked for us here at FDD. She's moved on, but once you work at FDD, you have no choice but to come back and speak with us on the FDD morning brief. It's in the contract, or so I'm told. At any rate, we're thrilled that Rebecca has agreed to speak with us live this morning.
Good morning.
Just describe this multi-layered missile defense that Israel has. Iron Dome, David Sling, Arrow. How does it all work? And why does Israel need so many different systems?
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for having me on. Good morning. And it was a great pleasure to work with the FDD team. And I still love to collaborate with y'all. So it's a real pleasure to be here. So Israel, it actually has it's similar to the way the United States actually does missile defense. Both here at home and how we think about it regionally, which is that it's layered. It takes a layered approach. So missile defense goes through evolutions. And just for your listeners, I'm sure your listeners and viewers know this, but when we say missile defense, we're talking about purely defensive systems. They don't have an offensive capability. They're designed to actively intercept incoming missiles from an aggressor. And so that's what they're designed to do. Obviously, Israel has a great need for this because of the enormous amount of raids, rockets, and missiles that Israel has to deal with. So it really was a necessity to invent something that could intercept the enormous amount of incoming missile and rockets that would come in from Gaza. And so that's what sort of put the pressure on the Israelis to come up with this interceptor system. And so the famous one, of course, is Iron Dome. And then it has, as you said, a layered system. So it intercepts sort of the smaller ones that are come regularly, the rockets. And then it have David Sling and then the Arrow system for the larger missiles that it has to intercept, because they're not all pointed the same direction, nor do they have the same capacity to intercept the same kind of incoming weapons. And so Israel has this sort of layered system, and then it has different deals with other countries for particular exports from other countries who have needs for this kind of system as well.
Yeah, and I guess when we talk about David Sling, that's considered to be mid-range, right? So stuff that's coming from longer distances from places like Iraq or Syria, let's say. And then Arrow, that's stuff that goes into outer space. Is that right? Or one of the Arrow systems?
Yes, it can go. It's exo-atmosphere. So it's the bigger, it's going to intercept the bigger missiles coming from further away. So as you said, if we had a map here, you could see so you think of Iron Dome as intercepting things that are closer range, David Sling getting bigger, the radius, and then Arrow is from further away. And Israel has that need from different places and different locations and larger incoming missiles that would be headed their direction.
Clearly and obviously what we've seen out of the missiles coming out of Houthi territory, that's Arrow territory. And then I'm assuming that if Iran decides to respond to that attack that occurred the other day against a senior IRGC official and they fire a projectile out of Iran, I'm going to assume that that's also Arrow that would probably intercept, right, given the distance.
Right, that's right. And it's important too, when you think about, you know, this is Israel's homeland missile defense. This is to protect their homeland, obviously. Then these weapon systems can be used for the United States in a regional capacity. That's how we talk about it. So our homeland defense system, obviously, if we think about it in the same way that Israel does, it's much larger interceptors, et cetera, to handle missiles that are coming from much further away. But then the Arrow weapon system can be used really well for the United States if we were to have it in a regional context, depending on what we want to protect U.S. forces in the region, et cetera. And right. I believe it's Finland. Finland just signed a deal, I think, recently for David Sling with the Israelis, because they would have the need for that for their particular issues.
Yep, they got a few challenges on their border. And we'll get to that maybe in a little bit. We didn't talk about lasers, which I think maybe we'll leave that for now. It's an undeveloped technology, or it's not fully developed, but we know that the Israelis are working on that, what they call Iron Beam. That would be that last layer for even shorter range stuff.
So if we can talk about that just real quick, why that's so important. So the constant challenge technologically that Israel must always deal with, and we all have to deal with it, but they have to deal with it in an acute way, is just the sheer number of rockets and missiles that they have to be able to defend against. And it becomes very, very expensive if you're developing. It's very expensive, very hard, technologically challenging to develop defenses. And so if you're going to build a defensive system to protect your people, it gets very expensive. So, and you run out of your magazine has to be pretty full to be able to handle everything that's headed your way. And so the Israelis are always looking for ways to do this more cost effectively. And so the brilliant thing about, Iron Dome is that it very smartly is able to, the radar can detect an incoming rocket, and then it can essentially decide sort of where it's headed. And then if it's not headed in a populated area or an area that is undefended but of high value for Israel, you know, they can let those ones go that are not headed in an area they want to defend. And then they can intercept it when it is headed towards cities, towards people, or towards an area that they want to defend. And so it can pick and choose. So that algorithm is really, really important. And that gets at that cost problem. But then the directed energy would also help, because you basically have an endless magazine. You can continue to shoot at incoming rockets or missiles. And so that technology is really, really important, and we're keeping an eye on that.
Yeah, obviously, you know, electricity is pretty cheap. And if that's all it takes, then Iron Beam would be amazing. Of course, the Iron Dome batteries are not cheap. You know, when the Israelis do fire them, when they see the need to use them, to intercept costs somewhere around $50,000 a pop. And you compare that to some of these rockets that are being fired out of Gaza that cost a few $100. The discrepancy there is huge, and it's certainly a drain on the Israeli treasury. But let me ask you about something else. Yesterday, we heard about Israel intercepting a drone off the coast of Eilat in the southern part of Israel. This appears to have been done from a seaborne vessel using Iron Dome. So what's the significance there? They're making a big deal about it in Israel.
Well, anytime you are, the Israelis, we've gotten so used to Iron Dome that it seems it's not easy, but it seems that we've gotten used to it, that they're able to do this. But anytime you actually change the mode or the way that the platform, it becomes another technological hurdle to be able to do that. So to be able to do it at sea is obviously very important, because there's all kinds of Iranian proxies that are operating around around the sea. And so if you have that capability where you're providing another additional protection from those critical areas, that's an evolution of the system. And so it is significant that they were able to successfully test it. And Israel tends to be on the front end, on the cutting edge of being able to develop and design these kinds of things, given the sheer necessity of being able to do it.
Well, I think that's good news. I'll count that as a positive in a realm right now where we don't see a ton of good news. So yeah, I'm going to take that. All right, let me ask you this. What's your sense of how all of these different systems that we've talked about, how do they work against this threat of PGMs, the precision guided munitions? And we know that Hezbollah is said to have, let's say, 1,000 or 1,500 of these missiles or rockets that can be guided, that they can be maneuvered from the ground in Lebanon. These are advanced weapons that Hezbollah has been stockpiling for the eventual all-out clash that is looming with Israel. Will the Israeli multi-layered defense system work against these projectiles that Hezbollah has in store?
Well, it's a good question. So the reason that has such a high success rate, I mean, I think the Israelis say it's still above 90%, is that they're still dealing with the kind of projectile that has a somewhat predictable trajectory. So the algorithm, the way it works is if you get it, pick it up on your radar, you generally know its trajectory. If it's ballistic or if it's mostly ballistic, you can know where it's going to end up, and it gives you a higher rate probability of kill. So to the extent that the incomings become more maneuverable, much harder, less predictable, it becomes much harder. to be able to predict and intercept and hit. So that's why it requires constant evolution. But this gets back to a conversation that you and I had earlier, Jonathan, which is that one challenge that's sort of the other side of how successful missile defense has been for Israel is it has permitted people to get a bit complacent. They have a high degree of trust in the success of these missile defense systems. And so you often see sort of famously, you know, the weddings that continue to go on in the middle where you see Iron Dome intercepting missiles. And so it's given, there's a high degree of trust there among the Israeli population that the system is going to work. But it's not something they should take for granted because the enemy is always evolving their ability to get around the system, create new ways to make it very, very difficult. And obviously October 7th was a horrible example of outmaneuvering the way that Israel has really, you know, put a lot of weight on how it's going to defend its people. And so that you're always going to find ways to kind of outmaneuver it. So and the last thing I'll say on that too, but the layered missile defense that Israel has also provided the Israeli government a lot of decision space for how it wants to respond to these enemy attacks against Israel. So the Israeli people become, you know, used to them and rely on them a lot. And the Israeli government, to a large extent, has become, you know, a lot more restrained than what it would otherwise be if it didn't have this defensive system. And so a lot of the accusations about Israel being, you know, too harsh, if you just sort of can look historically, Israel's been extremely tolerant and very restrained. And in large part, they've had the luxury to do that because of the layered missile defense system.
I think there may be a good article there, Rebecca. I'm just going to put it out there. But I think you're absolutely right. This over-reliance on technology is something that I've heard Israelis talk about, that they need to think twice now about this, that yes, it's given them time and space to make rational decisions, but what it also has done is it's postponed some of the tough decisions that Israel may need to take as it relates to Hamas or Hezbollah or even Iran. That defense is not how you win games. You need to play offense too, and that probably comes down to people, not technology. And I think that seems to be where the focus is right now, a return to the question of manpower. But that'll be something that we talk about maybe in a future show. I want to ask you one other question. Obviously, you do a lot of work with the U.S. military. There have been a lot of interceptions on the Red Sea with the Navy deployed there trying to battle the Houthis. These are U.S. missile defense systems at work. How have they done compared to the Israeli systems? Are they performing well? Are you satisfied with what you're seeing out of the U.S. Navy right now in the Red Sea?
Well, it's a two-part answer. Yes, it's this sort of, it gets back to the last thing you were just saying. We're pretty good at this. We're pretty good at intercepting rockets, missiles headed towards our ships. And that has also given the decision makers, the policy people back in Washington, a lot of more patience with responding to these Iranian proxies in the region. And you made the great point that, you know, you can, I mean, playing defense is it that gives you decision space, and you want to be able to preserve the thing that the enemy wants to hit, obviously, but then there should be in your strategy an obligation then to respond offensively to take out what I've said repeatedly is that, I mean, that's great. You intercept something coming from the Houthis, but then the response should be that the shooter knows that he's now going to die. I mean, that should be the immediate response. You immediately take out the shooter, and then you can also look for where all these other command centers are for who are directing these Houthis. So yes, they're doing well technologically. The Navy's been doing everything it's told to do and what's been commanded to do, but it has permitted us to not go on the offense like I think that we should.
Yeah, I'd also add that there are a couple of Iranian spy ships out there that are painting targets that to me seem like they shouldn't be out there in the Red Sea. But maybe that's another conversation for another time as well. I want to thank you, Rebecca Heinrichs, for coming back to FTD and joining us today live on the FTD Morning Brief. Appreciate your time.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Okay, here's what FTD has on tap for you today. FTD Adjunct Fellow Haysam Hassanein and Ophir Winter from the Israeli Institute for National Security Studies, otherwise known as INSS. They published a piece on the impact of the current Gaza war on Israel-Egypt relations. It's an important topic. It's been 45 years since Israel and Egypt signed the Camp David Accords. Haysam and Ophir's piece chronicles the ups and downs of Israel's longest regional peace deal, and they offer recommendations for how, with a little more transparency and calmer rhetoric from both sides, the relationship can overcome the stress posed by what I'm now calling the 10-7 wars, plural. Two, the head of FTD's Center on Economic and Financial Power, Elaine Dzensky, was up on Capitol Hill yesterday testifying before the Senate Caucus on International Narcotics Control. She urged the committee to address the glaring problem of anonymity in our financial system. When bad people can shroud their identity in the financial system, it leaves us vulnerable to manipulation, corruption, and even attacks by illicit actors and rogue powers. And our third topic that we're watching today, my colleagues Hussein Abdul Hussein and Behnam Bentaloglu joined FTD President Cliff May on the latest episode of Foreign Policy. They had a fascinating conversation about the Israeli strike on that senior IRGC official in Syria, highlighting the flaws in media coverage on that incident. There were, of course, many, and discussing what escalation may more realistically look like. I certainly encourage you to give that podcast a listen. That's it for today. Read our expert analysis on our website, FTD.org. Read our quick takes on X at FTD and support our work, as always, with a tax-deductible donation at FTD.org/invest. Tune in Friday for another episode of the FTD Morning Brief. I'll be on travel for the next few episodes, but trust me, I'm leaving you in very good hands. Friday's episode will be hosted by former IDF spokesman Jonathan Conricus, who's now with FTD, and he'll have on the show special guest, journalist and social media superstar Emily Schrader. You should definitely tune in. I know I will. I'm Jonathan Shanzer, signing off for FTD.